Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Sara Gone Rogue with me, Sara Gone. Apologies if I'm sounding a little sort of nasal. It is the season to have a bit of a cold. Nothing serious, just may sound a little bit more like your adult son than, shall we say, a woman of a certain age. And here we are at Sara Gone Rogue to look at the issues of politics and related that affect our society. And I thought I'd just give a little update with regard to the circumstances surrounding Jacob Zuma's daughter, Duduzile, who had embarked on a program, for want of a better word, of recruiting young men from the MK fold, if not from MK itself, or the MK party rather, to attend training in Russia to become, I don't know, bodyguards, they thought. Whether it was in fact to just provide some resources for the Russian fight against the Ukraine, I'm not sure, because they ended up in the Donbass in the sort of heat of warlike territories. So these poor guys had been desperate to come home because that's not what they expected. And it became apparent that, you know, this was possibly trafficking or worse, and both the DA and a stepsister laid criminal charges against her for her activities. This then resulted in her resigning as a member of parliament, which by all accounts was no great loss because she didn't attend much herself. I think public service in the admirable sense is not really an activity that she pays large store by. Anyway, apparently the Russians paid 14 million rand for these guys who I don't think would have made a great deal of difference to their manpower in fighting this war. And it seems, despite denials about MK, the party's involvement in this whole process, as long ago as mid-September, Jacob Zuma himself travelled to Russia. I don't know if it was only, but he went there to plead for the case of getting these guys back, or at least removing them from a war zone. And Putin would not see him, nor would the defense minister, which is all rather telling in regard to the actual influence that Russia has or cares about the South African situation. And maybe they've assessed that supporting the MK party and supporting Jacob Zuma doesn't really promise much in the way of dividends, despite the real possibility that what these guys were actually sent for was to prosecute some sort of insurrection here or coup in the future, and pave the way for greater Russian involvement and access to resources. So it's all a bit of speculation, but it does look really, really rather messy, and not least for Zuma himself. I mean, post her resignation, a media conference was held to try and, you know, explain. I don't know if it did much to explain the situation, but she was not given up for answering any questions during this period. So the plight of the 17 men who desperately want to go home carries on, and they're apparently going to have to get them back. They're going to have to repay the 14 million rand that Russia allegedly gave them for these people. It's a very, very strange story, but it has led to the arrest of five suspects who seem to have been going en route to Russia. They were arrested at OR Tambo, and you know, whether there's a sort of concerted effort to create a sort of armed grouping here, or whether it's ending up being rather slapdash, I don't know, but the police services seem to be onto it at last, and who knows, maybe we'll uncover something more dastardly. But the MK party under Jacob Zuma really doesn't seem to do a great deal with efficiency or with regard to the good services of the South African people.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Well, next week, there's some very important interviews to appoint the next National Director of Public Prosecutions. Now, Shamila Botoy's term comes to an end at the end of this year, and it's been a mixed term. She both had to withstand the attack on all aspects of the judiciary and the justice sector, and saw resistance as a result of Zuma's undermining of those institutions, and really wasn't seen to achieve much in the way of prosecuting politicians and other senior people in society who have been implicated in corruption. So there are 6 candidates out of an original 32, and interestingly, 4 are women and 2 are men. Now, the interviewing panel is chaired by Justice Minister Mameluke Okubai, which does raise some questions, since the public prosecutions is intended to be independent, assisted by the chairperson of the Human Rights Commission, chair of the Commission on Gender Equality, and the chairperson of the Public Service Commission, as well as representatives from essentially what are two black lawyers' associations. So one may, worry about a little more widely about whether the people doing the interviewing are sufficiently able to judge who should hold that position. The expectations on the next national director will be considerable, because there will need to be tough experience and ability to manage what is a complex organization on the one hand, and delivering prosecutions that give certainly the public impression that something is actually being done, and that the obstacles that Shamila Botoy encountered are actually capable of it being overcome. Four of the candidates are women, and they all appear to have had experience in public prosecutions. One is a director of public prosecutions in the Western Cape. The other was substantially involved with the National Directorship of Public Prosecutions, Hermione Cronier, and she's been freelancing for a while after she essentially ended up having a blowout with Shamila Botoy, but she's by all accounts highly competent, and the position she held, which she eventually left from, was the Investigating Directorate Against Corruption, which is now led by Andrea Johnson, who is also a candidate for the position. And it seems like these particular women, the greatest sort of criticism against them is that they have not handled staff particularly well, but one doesn't have enough idea and knows that there is complexity within the organization, and there are contradictions and conflicts between staff members, whether this is necessarily going to be a hindrance or not. The fourth lady does not have a connection to the NDPPA. She is the advocate Jennifer Kanyile, who serves as the chairperson of the Global Coalition to Fight Financial Crime, and has had experience in the Financial Intelligence Center and director of public prosecutions in the Free State. She did act as Deputy National Director of Public Prosecutions and head of the NPS, and seems currently to be the favorite to take up the position. And it might be an idea to have someone from outside of the prosecution's authority to do so. The fifth applicant is a male, Adrian Karl Mopp, who seems is a currently deputy director of public prosecutions in the Western Cape, and has been involved both as a detective in SAPS, which is perhaps something to really commend him, as well as a senior state advocate in the investigating directorate for organized crime at the offices of the Office of the Auditor General. He's been a public prosecutor in Kimberley and Makanda. So he seems to have, again, the necessary public prosecuting experience to take on the challenges. The most extraordinary and the sixth candidate is Advocate Menzi Simelane. Now, as you may remember from the dim distant past under Zuma, he was appointed to the National Directorate of Public Prosecutions and was found to have acted to not to be the fit and proper person that the NPA Act requires for the NDPP, because he basically was dishonest to the Genwala Commission, which was looking into then to Vusi Pikile's fitness to hold office of the NDPP. And his position, Simelane's position as the office bearer of the entity, was overturned by the Constitutional Court for his performance at the Genwala Commission. So Simelane is not a personality that one would associate with an organization desperately needing to improve its, be seen to improve its performance and retain and improve its level of trust with the public as regards to dealing with corruption and crime at the highest levels that impinge on the ability of South Africans to be properly serviced. And the invalidation of his appointment and his dishonesty at the Genwala Commission seemed to have been excused on the basis that he wasn't struck off the roll as an advocate, and you know, the, no specific finding into his honesty was found by the Constitutional Court. Well, if that's correct, then he was at least, it was at least implied that he was an improper person to stand as candidate. So hopefully he won't be seriously considered in, for whatever reason, the myriad of reasons that have come before for him for taking up this position.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
I'm joined this morning by my favorite female experienced journalist and trainer of journalists to talk about a subject that I've been quite keen to raise, and that is the feminization of culture, and culture implying both politics and the non-governmental world, and basically areas where women can be influential over our aspects of our society. And she wrote an article arising from her concerns about the feminization of culture from a podcast she had listened to. Patty Clay, welcome again to Chai FM, but welcome to the Sargon Rogue Show. And please give us some idea as to what it is that sort of raised questions for you about the feminization of culture. It obviously it's particularly pertinent to America and the West, but it does raise issues about elements of this of the same culture in arising in South Africa.
Yes. Good morning to you. Another rogue joins you.
Thank you.
So, I really, you know, I wrote an article a while back, which was based on something the Financial Times had printed, which was about the Asian young women move to the left. Mm-hmm. So you've mentioned now sort of, you know, South Africa and Western democracies, but in Asia, they're also finding young women voting to the left because many of them are feeling there is a more sort of, they want another approach. And so I've kind of been watching where women are going in politics and what it's meant with women having freedom, as we feminists were fighting for it, and for me back in the 70s, and feeling we needed to really push a little bit, if not quite a lot, to get some treatment and be able to go where we want to go. I think there was a song along those lines. And then listening to Helen Andrews' speech, in fact, it was her address at the National Conservatives, to the National Conservatism organization. And I was interested because a lot of what she said was true. I mean, women have made huge inroads into things, especially in America, into organizations, into politics in America, the politics here, politics in the UK. And is there a risk that we will get lopsided again as we were before? And I think that's really the gist of it. I was feeling we wanted to be equal. Are we now not tilting the scale? And she felt that it was time to take the finger off the scale.
Okay. I mean, I think the success...
Well, the thumb. The masculine thumb.
I think this is largely can be seen in the election of Zoran Mandani to the position of New York mayor, because 84% of women between the ages of 18 to 29 voted for him, and 65% of women aged 30 to 45, we could argue should know better, supported him, and he's appointed an all-female mayoral transition team. Now, there you'd see very much the attraction of the sort of socialist idea of free buses in New York and state-owned, theoretically cheaper grocery stores, and it's that very sort of move to the sort of softer, more concerned aspect of politics that raises the question, because neither of those ideal sort of provision of services is likely to come without a significant cost, and there's no indication that those costs have been calculated, and that seems to be part of what's the concern about the feminization, is it goes for the concerns and the feelings towards the betterment of society without looking at the limitations and some of the harsh realities.
Yes, I think that's it. You know, you lean too far one way. You're gushing and wanting to save the world and have everybody together and you know, uplift the poor, all sort of great aims and goals. But you also have to do the calculations. How do you do it? How much will it cost? Can it be done? And should it be done in some instances? Should we be falling over ourselves to help other people if we regard other people as individuals with their own agency, as the modern parlance would have it? Mm. So I do think we need to look at this desire to kind of make other people's lives better, even really without consulting with them sometimes, you know, because you have this over... It leads to a kind of feeling of knowing better than other people, which as a liberal I find quite disturbing. I also think in business, they've been preaching for so long that we need to have diversity in business and we need to hear all people talking. So how come we've been shutting out a lot of men in discussions about what are they? Women areas of the arts and culture and NGOs and charitable work, is that not a male area as well? Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's just, can we find a balance between the wonderful qualities men have and the wonderful qualities women have? Mm-hmm. And say they need each other because those qualities kind of are taming each side and preventing it from going into excess or extreme. If you just want to have free buses and you don't know how to do it, or you're not working on a system that will change the way we transport people, then, you know, it's pie in the sky and it's not achievable.
Well, my concern there is also whether it's a good idea to make free stuff available and for people not to sort of pay for the services they get because of the sort of empathy of the commute and all of those aspects of people's lives that sort of need to be made easier. But surely it involves a case of educating women, getting better education, getting access to what they can, how they can empower themselves. Because what strikes me as this empathy element is that it tends to see the people that it's most concerned about as victims rather than as people with agency who need to lead their own lives and develop their own futures.
Yes, and I do wonder if the generation of women that we, and when I say we, I mean boomers, have brought up are a little too spoiled.
Yeah.
and then kind of they either have a guilt on that, and so they want to help others, admirable as it is, and they want to do it. And I don't know, is there something we did wrong? Also was the question as boomers, go into it, but I do wonder why these young women who are the children of boomers or just about, you know, descendants of boomers have turned so very concerned to uplift others. Maybe they feel they don't need upliftment anymore and they must uplift others. They must find a victim. They were their parents were the victim. Now they must find new victims. I don't know quite what impels us. But I do despair. I do think young women who don't want to have children, young women who, kind of when they don't succeed, and this is a point Helen Andrews made in something else that I listened to of hers, that she felt, and this was entirely subjective, I suppose, she didn't really cite much sort of scientific evidence or polls for this, was that young women going into STEM careers, and battling as programmers and things in technology or whatever, or even making inroads there, didn't like the environment very much. And they become quite politicized against people and then rather turn their talents to politicizing the fact that they're not being treated equally. And I wonder, well, is there some truth? Or a lot of women don't have the ability to get into that kind of technical thing or don't want to have the desire. Mm. And yet there becomes a sort of resentment builds up when they're in areas where they maybe are not comfortable.
Mm.
And it's not their thing. Mm. And then they have to find another thing to make it good for them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, women seem to have progressed considerably, tending now to be in the majority in the university environment in areas like law, medical school, academia, and some of the sciences. But they still are the minority in I suppose what you'd call the hard sciences of areas like engineering and that. And I think essentially what you're looking for is equality of respect and the ability to tackle discrimination if you find it, because there will always be these discrepancies based on, God forbid, and I hate to mention it, biology.
Oh, yes, you were going to mention it. Thank you.
The B word.
Yeah. Women are women and they can't be anything else. And that may mean some physical limitations in some areas and some physical abilities in others. They can dance better.
Mm.
No, that's a generalization. But I really think, we shy away. Yes, we do. Let's just admit, we do have physical things. There's some women who are stronger.
Mm.
And there are some women who can do things, but they are not the general number.
Mm.
Perhaps you have to look at that. And why can't we just accept that that is why we need to work together? Mm. We want to work together with everybody else, it seems, you know, the younger generation wants to work together with everybody else, but they need to work together with, you know, guys who were supposed to be their first partners in a way. And I'm not an old-fashioned, everybody must get married and have babies.
Right.
But I do think it is a fairly natural order of things that you can follow. And if you choose not to follow it, that is fine as well. But that is usually going to make you somewhat of a minority. Mm. And that should be fine. You should be respected in that different area. But I just fear this total suicidal empathy that we have could really damage society in a way. Well, it's the same. Toxic masculinity damages it.
Yeah. Well, it's basically both the minority influences coming into what I would call the majority environment, both affecting it and tempering it, or either way, whichever way, wherever the dominant side is felt, but also learning to adjust. I mean, we both grew up in probably environments that were largely male-dominated, and it's the adjustment, it's partly the adjustment and getting to understand what you're dealing with that makes you capable of progressing, in fact, making an environment more amenable to women. But one of my concerns arises, and she talks about feminization largely being reflected in wokeness. And, you know, we've talked about empathy. We've talked about looking at safety, providing safety over allowing people to take risk, and conformity and cohesion over competition. Now, as a consequence, what poll findings are doing is finding that women, you know, particularly women who are progressing through the sort of areas of power in society, are less in favor of free speech. Yes. They want a more, they're pursuing a more inclusive society, but they want more in favor of free, they're less in favor of free speech, and they tend to be more accepting of forms of immigration, even if they're immigration, including and particularly illegal immigration. And it's this that doesn't take account for the whole lot of complexities and nuances and, you know,
yes,
issues that have to be accounted for a society to run effectively.
Yes, it's almost as if it's a kind of short-term thinking sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, is it lacking in strategy? Are we lacking in strategy? I don't know, dude. You know, clearly they've done tests which show we have higher rates of cognitive empathy and things like that. They don't talk very much about what we're lacking as women. Mm. So, you know, maybe we have some little 0.0003 something less than men in making a strategic decision. So let's use that strategic thinking in planning what does immigration mean for one.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's all nice to gather up the puppy at the side of the road because it's been abandoned. But, you know, what if your children are allergic to it? Mm. You know, to bring it down to a very simple level, this kind of wanting to save the world in one way but not wanting to consult with other people. Yeah. Especially of the male persuasion, seems to me a kind of recipe for impending disaster. Everything should be a consultation in a way,
yeah.
And it's all very well to decide things alone in the room or take the decisions as a group of females, but maybe you want to check it against somebody else, just as you would say, you know, the diverse woke element would say we have to consult all cultures, we have to bend to all cultures.
Yeah. Well, perhaps I just want to give one current example in the non-governmental organization NGO sector in South Africa, where the National Education and Training Manager, the Black Sash, has been part of a campaign to have the Kifness, who's a very well-known, very successful musician, removed from a Western Cape government, a concert at Kirstenbosch at the end of the month because of his views he's expressed on Imtiaz Suleiman, the chairman of Gift of the Givers. And he's he's expressed comments about, you know, really what, you know, where does he stand? We know he's very pro Palestine and anti Israel, but there's a very strong. There have been accusations elsewhere, not and along the same lines of the fact that he has a relationship with Hamas or people related to Hamas that is less than admirable, and this lady is amongst those pressing for his removal from the bill. Now here you really are, you know, interfering with literally freedom of expression and the right to be heard and that because. The views expressed are not yours. This to me is the prime example of one of the areas of potential problems, of potential move away from liberalism.
Yes, I mean, you know, when I mentioned the spoiled, I just this links to this because I've had some run-ins with this young woman from Black Sash for some time because I am very angry that she is a communicator and trainer for the Black Sash, mm-hmm. and is allowed to put her personal views as regards Palestine across mm-hmm. under the when everyone knows who she is for the Black Sash, mm. and she doesn't really draw a distinction between her personal life and her beliefs. Mm. And so for me, that's always been problematic. And I had great difficulty, I must say, reining in young people and saying, when you're a journalist, for instance, you should not be completely giving away your opinions to everybody. Mm. They should be fairly murky and people unable quite to assess where you're coming from. Mm. And especially if your organization isn't talking on that particular subject. So it has always worried me that, and people seem resistant. They want free expression when it comes to their social media, and then they want to close down other talks.
I think we could probably sum it up as the concern about suicidal empathy of feminization. But Paddy, I have to cut it there. Thank you very much for joining me. Just to have a little riff in a different direction for a change. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
I just wanted to talk about a concern I had with an interview that Rob Sahursov, who heads up Truth Report, which consists of a number of podcasters on largely political issues. He interviewed Prince Moshele, who's a sort of a well-known public intellectual and commentator on all things political, and he's outspoken and usually honest about the ANC's shortcomings. And I generally found when I've listened to him, and he's probably been interviewed on Chai FM before, that one largely is impressed by his honesty. And I mean, if it's a little bit, if some of his statements are a little bit overblown and sometimes seem exaggerated, largely seems to have a refreshing take on things. I mean, he, despite, shall we say, a natural antipathy to the DA and all involved, the idea of Helen Ziller becoming the mayor of Joburg, he said he would support it on the basis that, you know, what was most important was the ability to overturn the rot that is set in after years of predominantly ANC and allied governance of Johannesburg. And, you know, he's spoken about the need for black and white people to work together in politics and business to see a revival in South Africa in general. And he commented in this particular interview that foreigners should like visiting and living, coming to buy property in this country, and that we can learn from some of the changes that occurred in Singapore, in places like Singapore, Sweden or Mauritius, that really made them economically successful and attractive. And he thinks that South Africa could become the Switzerland of Africa. Well, I think that might be overstating it, but as I said, it tends to be a tendency to overstate things. But my concern came in when Rob Herzog asked him about a relationship between America and South Africa and whether it was a force for good, at which point he says, for him, as controversial is that the strategy of the U.S. towards South Africa does not appear to come from the U.S., but rather from Israel. And that because South Africa has offended Israel by taking Israel to the International Court of Justice over allegations of genocide, that essentially whatever the USA does is being done, and their opposition to the fact that South Africa took such action was entirely at the behest of the Israelis. Now, that in itself shows a fairly limited understanding of either America or Israel or the nature of the relationship between them and what and how the extent to which it serves America, which is very much the zeitgeist of Trump's policy that it's America first. But let me quote what he goes on to say, because it's this, the standard old tropes came out in full force. But then the Israelis control America. The Jewish lobby is powerful, and we can go into the history of how the Jewish lobby was constructed. That's why Trump was frustrated with Netanyahu. We've seen it on a number of occasions, but there was nothing he could do. There is nothing he could do in commerce, and as powerful as America is, so it's Israelis who have instructed the Americans to kick South Africa. That's the game here. So poor Trump is wearing soccer boots. He's been given a football called South Africa by the Israelis. They're saying to him, kick them, kick this ball. He's kicking, he doesn't know where, he doesn't even see the goalpost. Sure, there's no strategy. That's what's going on here. Now, with all due respect, other than to the effectively cheap, old-fashioned, completely repeated anti-Semitic tropes, he's really not got, he has not got a sense of what Trump would like from South Africa, what Trump has asked for South Africa, and the fact that the taking the case to the ICJ, while it's an issue, is not the main issue. It's about the fact that investment into South Africa is very unattractive, and that BEE and expropriation without property, which diminishes property rights, are major concerns for Trump, and that the failure to concede on any of these issues or show any sign of concession, and all his, and he's and on BEE, he's just asking for an exemption for American companies from BEE. Oh, that he would be asking for a change to BEE entirely, and then to sort of, because Trump and the American administration is itself against South Africa's referral of Israel to the ICJ, it suddenly becomes the dominant thought of the all-powerful Jewish Israel lobby against things. All I can say is shame on Prince Moshele, and it would certainly affect my sense of anything, whether he could speak with authority on anything else. One understands that the relationship between South Africa and America, and throwing into that mix the relationship with Israel, would not be his prime areas of interest or comment. But part of the sign of a substantial and meaningful commentator is not to comment on things that you don't know well, or to indicate that this is not necessarily an area of your main concern and this is what you think. But he stated it very very emphatically, leaving poor Rob Herzog to have to try and deflect away by looking at getting comment on local issues. I don't think he expected it to quite go in that emphatic, what I call lazy anti-Semitic tone. So, the problem with the culture of podcasting and sort of everyone going onto podcasts and treating them, and they become very much sort of casual. The tone of podcasts often becomes casual, and the fact that you're actually being subjected to a serious interview gets forgotten along the way, and these and perhaps these idiotic outbursts become more easily expressed instead of being watched for what one says.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
We've spoken quite a bit in the last few weeks about the lack of economic growth in South Africa, exacerbated by poor economic policy that really doesn't encourage investment, either on the local or in the foreign sense. But global financial organizations are concerned about the widening growth gap between South Africa and its African peers. Now, S&P Global Ratings, together with IMF and World Bank, have been projecting a median 4.5% growth rate for Africa over the next 3 years, and between 4 and 4.5% medium-term growth in sub-Saharan Africa, with South Africa just sitting at 1.8% growth, which is less than half the continental rate and is essentially dragging down the continent and certainly sub-Saharan Africa as a result. Now, generally, Africa's growth rate increases when there's a strong demand for commodities and slumps when that demand dries up, which shows a gap in economic growth and engines for economic growth in the African context. So it's gold prices, surging metals, strong portfolio inflows. It's not concerned with structural transformation around the continent. But still, South Africa is dragging everyone down and really should have the potential for much faster growth. And it's hamstrung by the anti-growth policies that we talk about and that Trump talks about, threats to property rights, race-based laws through BEE preference. And then there's the one that we alluded to in our one of our earlier topics, and that is a very high crime rate. And the very high crime rate, which concerns, personal crime is always a very difficult one to deal with. But mafias and similar such entities and drug trafficking, which the corruption at government levels amongst government office holders, it's that in particular that has to be seen to be attacked to bring down the crime rate that would not attract investment because rights would may well disappear under the welter of crime. And also, if investors want to bring in people from overseas to live and to grow their organizations, which is beneficial to the South African economy in general, the crime rate has to be personal crime rate has to be seen to be tackled. And with seeing our top crime fighters in the front of commissions over their corruption and links to organized crime, we're not doing ourselves any favors whatsoever. And the lag, for all those reasons, will continue unabated, unless and until the ANC continues to struggle in the voting arena, and that looks like happening in the next local elections and the national elections going forward. But maybe they should see that local elections were not swayed by the president's sense of his own performance at the G20. It's the bread and butter economic issues that sway it. And the local elections last week in particular, were not particularly kind to the ANC. They lost. They either lost seats to other parties or they saw their majorities completely whittled away in some instances. So that is the state of the nation as Sorogon Rogue sees it as currently, and I would commend you to go to my Substack where I just articles and ideas to flow that may be of interest, and you can find it at sara281.substack.com, and otherwise to come back to Sorogon Rogue, the Sorogon Rogue show on Chai FM next week, and see what else we can keep you informed about to make it your own political and life decisions. Thanks, and see you then.